Hi, I'm Sabrina and he's Marcus.
And we are two of the founders of the Black Trail Runners. You can find us on Instagram at the Black Trail Runners.
We're a community and campaigning group seeking to increase inclusion, participation and representation of Black people in trail running.
If something resonates with you, please let us know and share online.
Also, leave your review on the podcast platform that you selected as it helps our podcast grow. Your support helps to make this podcast possible.
Thank you for downloading this episode. Now, let's head to the conversation.
The Checkpoint is supported by The North Face, whose fundamental mission remains unchanged since 1966, to provide the best gear for their athletes and the modern-day explorer, support the preservation of the outdoors, and inspire a global movement of exploration. Hi Donna, how are you?
Hey Sabrina, I'm good, thanks. Nice to have a little catch up with you. Haven't actually met you in person, I don't think.
We haven't. You know, we've been co-founders of Black Trail Runners for, well, since last July, and we have spoke so much on the phone, done so many Zoom calls, but we actually haven't met in person yet, have we?
No, but 2021 will be our year.
I think 2021 has to be our year. If it's not our year, Donna, then I'm going to give up and just stay in bed under the covers. What have you been up to this week?
So I've been quite busy work-wise. I just started a new job, nothing really exciting, but it's a new job anyway, so I'm doing lots of training. I've got my running schedule mojo back. So I'm just trying to sort of get into a regular routine that I was in sort of back end of last year, running like 4 or 5 times a week, and focusing on the shorter distances at the moment. I've James from Centurion Run is not listening, but I think I'm going to bin SDW 50 next month. I've not done enough long runs for it.
That's out there that doesn't know, what's the SDW 50?
Oh, sorry. I shouldn't use acronyms.
Well,
it's a Southway 50. It's a 50-mile race on beautiful trails, and it's hosted by one of our allies, Centurion Running. It's a beautiful race. I've never actually run it. I've run over on the South Downs, and I think I volunteered for the 50 and the 100 two or three times, and I keep promising to run it, and I just haven't got there yet.
And you're doing it. So you're doing it next month.
I'm scheduled to do it next month. It was supposed to be on the weekend of the 10th of April. It's been put back to the 17th.
Yeah.
But I don't think I've got 50 miles in my legs at the moment.
But that's what training's for, eh?
Yeah, but I don't think there's enough time. If anyone out there listening knows of a training program that can get me through 50 miles, and I've got 4 weeks to train, and my longest run since January was 13 miles. Give me a tinkle.
Give the woman a tinkle. Anyone out there that has any crazy miracle kind of training plans that will make Donna fly around the South Downs Way next month, hit us up on the Instagram or the Twitter or the email. We want that plan.
Yes.
Donna, you know what? You've just got to keep moving forward in those things, haven't you? I mean, at the end of the day, your mental resilience is enough that, you know, by hook or by crook. And what is it they say? It's like 95% in the head anyway when it comes to these races.
Indeedy. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but my favourite word at the moment is defer, defer, defer.
Defer, defer, defer.
What about you, Sabrina? What's your week been looking like?
Oh, God, Donna. Well, I am in the early phases of a training block for a mountain, 100K in the mountains, that I am due to be going to the Pyrenees in July.
Wow.
But what with the news about travel, and also I haven't had my vaccination yet, and I think in terms of the travel corridors that in order to travel abroad you will need to have 2 vaccinations, and I'm not sure I'm going to get my second by July. So I managed to find myself a B race, which is in the Lake District, on the same date. So I'm very, very early in mounting ultra trail training. But unfortunately, yesterday I went over on my ankle.
Oh, no.
Yeah, absolute nightmare. It's something that I haven't done for a while. Any trail runners out there, any runners out there will know the nightmare that is ankle strains. And once you go over, it weakens that area, and the likelihood of you going over again is therefore kind of doubled and tripled. So that happened to me yesterday when I was out on a run. I felt sorry for myself. I sat in a field and cried. I hobbled back to my mum's house, and then I put my big girl's pants on, started doing my rehab, because it used to happen all the time. And managed to find my old ankle support, and I think it's just some ligament strains. I don't think it's too serious, but you know what it's like, Donna, when you're very early on in a training block, your head is just really like, I want to do this. I want to knock off all the sessions. I want to be strong. So a week in, me going over on my ankle, just all those dark thoughts kind of came in. But you know what? It's these things are sent to triers. This is the life of a trail runner. You know, I don't run on concrete, so therefore have to constantly be working on strengthening up those ankles and mobilizing them and the rehab. And it is what it is. You know, I'm lucky that I'm able to run. And that's what I keep telling myself. Yeah. You know, there are people out there that aren't able to do what it is that I do for mental health. So, you know, we pick ourselves up and we go again, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, hopefully you won't be out for too long and make a wobble board your friend.
Yeah, I'm getting that. I've got that wobble board out of the cupboard and it is becoming my best friend. But, you know, one person that has really inspired me is our interview guest today, Donna Fraser, OBE. What a woman. This interview is thought-provoking. It is inspirational. I started working with Donna last year when I took part in a UK Athletics Let's Talk About Race panel, and was then asked to be on a kind of working party, which is now called the Race Equality Network. And from the moment I met her, her story, her motivation, her work in the ED&I field, of which she was made an OBE for in January this year. It's just absolutely inspirational to hear another woman and be totally inspired and totally impassioned to want to be better and do better. So without further ado, let's get on to the interview with Donna Fraser, OBE. So today is March the 8th, 2021, and it is actually International Women's Day when I'm recording this interview with, you know, I'm not going to call her a girl crush, but kind of a bit of a girl crush. So I am here with Donna Fraser, OBE. Now, Donna is a 4 times Olympic athlete specializing in the 400 meters. She was born and raised in Croydon in the UK, for all of our international listeners. And she first knew that she wanted to represent her country at the Olympics after, I believe, watching the LA Games with her sister on TV in 1984. And that dream actually came true for Donna when she attended her first Olympics 12 years later. Donna herself, I think she's got a lot of claims to fame, but one of the interviews that I saw, Donna claims her claim to fame is in the 2000 Games, where she narrowly missed out on a medal by a boob in a performance that saw her shave almost a second off her PB. Her training partner that year, Kathy Freeman, won the gold, and the picture of Donna congratulating Kathy was beamed across the world. And for me and many others, showed the beautiful relationship that can develop between teammates, well, I say teammates, but training partners, athletes, and ultimately women. In 2009, Donna was diagnosed with breast cancer, but continued to train until she made the decision later that year to retire from competitive athletics. Donna's athletic and professional career led to her being appointed as the first UK Athletics ED&I, Equality, Diversity and Inclusion Lead. And latterly, her work with prominent voices in both elite and amateur athletics has led to me meeting her and latterly in us creating the Race Equality Network. And in January 2021, in the New Year's Honours List, she was awarded Order of the British Empire for her services to equality, inclusion and diversity in the workplace. Now, Donna, welcome to the Black Trail Runners Checkpoint podcast.
Hey, Sabrina. How you doing?
I'm good, thank you. I'm really good. And I'm just really grateful that you, out of your busy life, have given me an hour of your time to talk to you for our Checkpoint podcast. Now,
thanks, Sabrina. Anything for you, my lovely.
Oh, thank you. I am blessed. Now, Donna, I always start with a few icebreakers. Now, kind of normally I do these icebreakers for people that I may not have had a relationship with, etc. But actually, some of the questions are quite fun. So I just wanted to kick off your Monday morning with some just out there questions. So don't worry. Your heart's probably like, oh my God, what's she going to ask me? What's she going to ask me?
Well, it can't be any worse than being in an Olympic final. So let's go.
Exactly. Right. So it is International Women's Day today, and I've just shared actually a piece to camera that you've done about the power of women and the power of kind of relationship and inspiring women. Can you tell me one woman that inspires you and why?
Oh my gosh, I hate this question. Does it have to be one?
You know, no, it doesn't have to be one at all. If you have women that come into your head, tell me about them. Tell us about them.
Right. Okay. Let me start with my mum. Obviously, she brought me into this world. She came over to this country in the early 60s to join my dad, who had come here a year before herself. And, you know, the stories you hear in the 60s and even before that, when black people arrived in the UK, it wasn't an easy road whatsoever. But the reason why I say my mother, you know, they both were extremely resilient. They stuck at it. They brought up their girls. They had all girls, no boys, to be just that. And we did not know the stories and the trials and tribulations they went through until we were a lot older. And I think that takes a lot of gusto just to pursue what they needed to do to provide for the family and just bring up their girls to be independent individuals and strive to be the best that they could be. And they did just that. So, yeah, she's a role model to me. She's a bit feisty, so I think I get that from her a little bit. Coming from the Caribbean maybe as well, you know, they have to fight for everything and just be who they want to be. But, you know, and then my sister, there's a 10-year age gap between myself and my older sister. I mean, I've got three sisters in total, but one in particular, Jenny. She was the one who got me into athletics, as you rightly said in the intro. She loved her athletics. We watched athletics religiously. And I just wanted to be like her. She was a runner herself, but didn't get as far as I did. And she pushed me. She was the one that drove me around the country to get me to athletics competitions and gave me that confidence to do well, because I wasn't an outgoing person as a young, so I was extremely shy. And it was her that convinced my parents to let me go down to my local club and join up and help me blossom, I guess, as a person, not just from a sporting perspective, but as an individual, to grow that confidence I didn't have. And then also from an athletics perspective, Wilma Rudolph, as some of you may know, she had polio as a youngster, was told she'd never run, let alone walk, or walk, let alone run, should I say, the other way around. And she overcame that and made the Olympics and got a medal. So, you know, I've been surrounded by phenomenal women in my life. My godmother, who I say is my another mother, she was also by my side growing up. And my girlfriends, you know, I've met some phenomenal women in my athletics career, and they became my sisters that I travelled with, roomed with, supported. They supported me. I can't fault that. So my list is endless, in all honesty.
And, you know, that's, you know, our mothers, our sisters, our girlfriends, you know, I think it's, you know, I think about that support structure all the time. And, you know, we were talking just before this interview about the athletics in Turin that has taken the meet that took place this weekend, and how amazing our British team, our GB team have done. And what I saw in a lot of the pictures there were some amazing women supporting other women, you know, to share in the medals, to share in the joy, and that is just awe-inspiring.
Absolutely. And as you know, in athletics, it is quite an individual sport. But when it comes to the relays, and, you know, I've lived and breathed that, you could be with someone racing against them in the individual, and then a few days later, you're together as a team in the relay. And we became that sisterhood. And I was lucky enough to captain many of those teams. And we were just, I loved being part of that relay. You know, someone in that team may have beaten you the day before, but it did not matter. You parked that and you came together as a team. And we supported one another. There was no weak link. We worked together. And it's special. It really is when you, as a woman, that you've got people like that surrounded by, you know, and pushing you forward to achieve great things.
Absolutely. And we'll talk about a special relationship that you had in 2000 later on in the interview. But yeah. Okay. Second question. Right. We've been in lockdown, Donna. You know, today the kids go back to school, although my children aren't going back till after the Easter holidays, but that's something totally different. We're coming out of lockdown slowly. What I want to know is, Donna Fraser, where is the first place that you're thinking, I want to go on holiday there?
Well, my parents are in St. Vincent, and they're the ones I've been dreaming about going back to see. You know, they're miles away. It's not like they're in this country at the moment. So they're at the top of my list, St. Vincent and the Grenadines, to see my parents.
Oh, do you mind if you have a little Sabrina in your suitcase just to, you know, tag along, you know, just
I'll squeeze you in, no problem, with many others. I'll pay the extra for you.
And the third icebreaker question is, I'm a foodie, Donna. The reason I run all these crazy distances is because I love my food, but I love being fit, I love being healthy, but I love my food. One food that in lockdown you could not have survived without. It doesn't even need to be one food. Food that you couldn't have survived without.
That's a really good question, because if you'd asked me this question a couple of years ago, I'd probably say Branston pickle, but I've just really warmed towards peanut butter.
Ooh.
Because it seems to be really easy, especially between meetings. You think, oh, I slap some of that on some rye bread or whatever, crackers, whatever you've got. Peanut butter is the go-to thing at the moment. Oh, and sandwich spread, which is an old school thing.
Oh, old school. Oh, yes. Now, peanut butter, I've never liked peanut butter, but it seems to be the food of champions. So it's kind of this, as you say, like a quick hit thing that you can put on something, or you can even just put your finger in the pot. But I've had this thing about peanut butter all my life, and so I haven't yet had the courage to try, but maybe today is that day. But sandwich spread.
Now again, all of those three things you can eat just by the spoonful. I can anyway.
I just did, but I didn't even think they sold sandwich spread anymore.
Talk to me. You're not hanging with the right people, Sabrina.
Oh, God. Oh, you know what? We used to have sandwich spread sandwiches. You know, we when I grew up, was quite poor, et cetera, et cetera. And it was kind of the filling of choice for mum. But yeah, I kind of hit teenage years and sandwich spread along with, you know, those little chicken pate and liver and chicken that you would get in the little glass. Yes.
You're taking me back now. You really are. I'll send you a pot of sandwich spread, Sabrina. That'll be my gift to you as we come out of lockdown.
Thank you very much, Donna. Thank you very much. Right, let's move on to some less fun. No, not less fun questions. They're all fun. What I want to know is, taking you back,
taken you back to childhood, taken you back to that place in terms of your running, where it kind of might have started. What's the earliest memory that you have of running, firstly? And secondly, can you actually remember the time when you, little Donna, knew that you had something a bit special?
Yes, and it's as if it was yesterday. It's a memory that I hold really close to my heart, running away from my mum. No, I'm joking. on a serious note, no, the absolute memory is when I was 8 years old, representing my primary school. And I do have a photo of it, actually. All the other girls were much older than me. I was the youngest in the team. But again, I went to an all-girls primary school. Mm-hmm. And having those older girls to look up to, who protected me, I can safely say, through that whole journey of training in the playground to go into Croydon Arena, which seemed like the Olympics to me because it just seemed huge. That journey, I did feel protected and safe, and that to me, I hold close to my heart. But it was my primary school teacher, Miss Hughes, and ironically, my older sister went to the same primary school. And when I was born, my mum took my sister to parents' evening with me. And that same teacher, Miss Hughes, met me as a baby and then became my teacher later on. And she'd always tell that story when I was at school. I saw Donald in her pram when she was a baby, and it was so embarrassing. But she was the one who would always say to me, "Donna, when you're running, look straight ahead." We had a tree at the back end of our playground, and she said, "Just aim for that tree. Do not look left. Do not look right. Just run as fast as you can and be determined." Those were her words. And that determined bit has stuck with me throughout my life, on and off the track, regardless what is put in front of me, just be determined. And she was an amazing teacher, absolutely amazing. And I stayed in touch with her for many, many years and lost touch when I moved. But, she was the one that identified a talent in me and knew what made me spark and do well for the school. And that was something that was great within our school anyway. We were a proud school.
Oh, that just, yeah, it's so much that you said in that I want to explore. And the word that you, two words that you used, which my heart just kind of skipped a beat, was protect and be kept safe in terms of that journey as a kid. Let me ask you, what do you mean by that?
Well, I was the youngest. I was eight, you know, I was shy. And at that school, Winterbourne Junior School, as I said, the only girls' school still, I think, in Croydon, we looked after each other. It was a family. And I cried and cried when I left school, because I didn't want to leave. All the teachers were female as well. So I was surrounded by amazing individuals. And that protectedness was, they protected me because they knew I was shy. Yeah. And, you know, not that they held my hand, it wasn't like that, but giving me that encouragement and reassuring me that everything will be fine and you're going to do well. All those positive affirmations that helped me believe that I was going to win, and know that they were in the crowd as well. I mean, Winterbourne was a force to be reckoned with in athletics terms. Even when my sister was at school, we won everything, and our bib number was number 75. And you knew we were smart. We had our red t-shirts, our shorts. The school provided all of that, and spikes as well. And everything, we were just looked after, but to make sure that we excelled. And there was never any losers. We just supported one another. Those are the vivid memories I have.
Sounds like such an amazing community to be, you know, school to be kind of, you know, heralded as like best practice in terms of nurturing talent. Yeah. You know, I know from the stories that I hear, you know, grassroots level, you know, stories I hear from kind of schools, et cetera, et cetera. It's not always like that, is it? And Winterbourne sounds like, Wow, it sounds like the kind of golden, you know, the kind of, yeah, as I say, a best practice school to kind of hold up. Here's how to nurture talent.
Absolutely. And Miss Tilia was the headmistress, which you say that, we said it then, headmistress at the time. And, you know, she'd always say, "You're my young ladies." And that may be a bit wrong to say now because you're just students. But then, you know, she made sure that we were prim and proper. We represented the school. We were proud to represent the school wherever we went and looked out for each other. And I do remember when I was the top year at Winterbourne, when the first year started, a group of my friends made that effort to look after. We picked one first year girl to look after and look out for. So if they were, you know, wandering around the playground on their own or anything like that, we took it upon ourselves to go and look after that individual and says, you know, if any problems, if you're being picked on or anything, come to us because we're the older girls. And we weren't told to do that. But yeah, just me and my friends decided to do that. And that's the family atmosphere, the looked after approach we had. And I carried that through really into my senior school.
And what was that transition to senior school like? Did you have the what was the support like from kind of teaching staff, kind of other kind of school your peers there when you went to senior school? How was it the same? Did it change?
Yeah, completely different. And however, having said that, the teachers at Winterbourne prepared us for that. They did say it won't be like Winterbourne. It will be different. You're going to have to really be strong-willed. It will be a challenge. But it's a journey, you know, not those words, but, you know, that's how I remember it. And it was completely different. It was each to their own. There was none of that togetherness. You know, the friends I went to senior school with, who I was with at primary school, we weren't in the same classes all the time. So we had to look after ourselves. But, you know, playtime, we were back together and, you know, we'll upload and do whatever. So there was that togetherness, but not immediate as it was at Winterbourne. It was different and you had to grow, but it was part and parcel of the learning journey and growing up.
Mm. One thing that I saw that you spoke about in one of the speeches that I saw was, you know, you're big on mindset. You know, you're big on, you know, if we tell ourselves something enough, you know, we kind of almost bring it into fruition. And one of the things that I saw you talk about was, you know, when you were eight and you were, you know, and you were watching the Olympics and, you know, you were thinking, I want to be there. Mm-hmm. You know, that voice, you didn't necessarily say to yourself then, I want to be there and win gold, you know, and you talk about the power of mindset a lot. And it's something that I love listening to. Mm-hmm. So what's your thought around the positive mindset, you know, because a lot of people listening to this podcast will be either new to running and or they'll be, you know, have been running for years and years and years. And I think your experience of being an elite athlete and all that goes with that, I think we can learn a lot. And it really resonated with me what you said about what we tell ourselves, because of situations I've been in where I've maybe thought, you know, I can't get to the top of this mountain, or I can't run that fast, or I can't continue on this training block. It's too much. And it almost becomes this self-fulfilling prophecy. So I wanted to hear more from you about that as we go on to talk about your experience in the Olympics, etc.
Oh, definitely. And I guess this whole thought process, how I am, does stem from my primary school years, because another thing Miss Hughes would say to us all, not just me, is there's no such word as can't. You can try. And that again, has just resonated with me throughout. You know, you can give it a good go, at least try. By saying you can't, you've given up already before you've even started. And I just feel me as an individual, the journey I've had from the eight-year-old at Winterbourne to who I am today, there have been barriers, there have been negative moments. But again, that thought process of, you know what, Donna, you can't control other people, how they are. You can only control how you are. And it's whether it's a choice, whether you choose to stay down or get up and keep fighting. And I always try and use the latter. And those positive thoughts, we have the, well, I know I have them every, almost every 5 minutes or so, you know, think, oh gosh, I've got to have this meeting. Come on, Donna, it's only an hour's meeting. You can get through this. You know, and I feel uplifted and I finish it and I think, oh, wow. And the same thing when I go for a run, I think, oh, I've got to go for a 20-minute run. When I'm in it, it's like, well, Donna, you've started it. You're closer to the finish than you were a few minutes ago. It's turning that thought process around, flip that coin, turn a negative into a positive. It just really helps. And everyone is different. And you go back to the point where I said I watched the Olympic Games and I was like, I want to be there. I'm a colourful person. I think colourful. I think I'm upbeat as much as I possibly can. And I was like, wow, that looks so exciting. You know, it gave me that buzz, more the after party than anything else, to be honest. But, it's just like, wow, that looks so much fun. And I am a fun person. And to be a fun person, you can't be down in the doldrums 24/7. You need to be uplifting. Not saying I don't have down days. You know, I'm human at the end of the day, but it's the process I take to get myself out of those down days. And it doesn't take long. I make a promise to myself not to stay too long in the doldrums. Think, do whatever you need to do, Donna. If it's going for a walk, if it's buying something online, do whatever you need to do to uplift yourself. And it does work, and it has worked for me. It may not for everyone, but everyone can find a way that works for them.
I think there's so much to take away there. You know, I think, you know, knowing you and getting to know you more as kind of our journeys have kind of collided in you know, the work that, you know, the race with the Race Equality Network. I see you and I see fun and I see positivity, but also I know, being that person myself, that, you know, there are those times when, you know, just like everyone, that you do feel a bit dark, or you do feel, oh God, you know, how can I keep this energy up? Mm-hmm. And it's something that someone asked me this past weekend after when I was doing the Goggins 48 challenge, which was, how do you keep going when everything inside you is wanting you to stop? You know? And My response to that was, because I know that if I stop, I'm less near to home, to where I want to be, than if I just keep stepping forward, you know. Absolutely. Just keep moving forward.
Definitely. That self-talk, and you've maybe heard me say I've got an alter ego named Diane, and she is that person that will, I say person, she doesn't really exist, but she does in my mind, is the one that picks me up, you know, when I'm have that self-doubt. It's like Diane just shows up and she's like, what the hell are you talking about, Donna? Fix up, look sharp, come on, let's get moving. You know, and not many people see Diane. Now and again they think, oh, well, especially my old training partner used to say, oh, I saw a bit of Diane there. But it's bizarre. It sounds like I'm completely loopy, but I'm certainly not. But it works. You know, she's my other half. You know, she's the one that will pick me up and see things for what it is, and let's move forward. Stop dwelling on what happened yesterday. Let's move forward. This is another day.
I love that. I love, you know what? I hadn't actually, you know, in the interviews that I've watched or listened to, I haven't heard you refer to Diane. And I'm like, yes. Of course, like, why wouldn't you always have an alter ego? It's like Beyonce with her Sasha Fierce, isn't it? You know, yes, Beyonce, yes. Kind of, she says, you know, I'm quite a shy person, like to keep myself. But when she gets on stage, Sasha Fierce comes out. So your Diane, yeah. Here we go. There's top tip for anyone listening to this. Develop an alter ego.
It's a must, honestly. Well, you are talking to Donna right now. Diane's sleeping at the moment.
She's sleeping at the moment. So what I want to do is I want to come on to, you know, what you've called as your claim to fame. I think that it's a career highlight. But it's something that people that might not know too much or will remember. And this is the 2000 Olympics. This is the 400 meters final. This is you not necessarily getting the lane that you had been used to getting. So can you talk us talk our listeners around what that was about. By the way, listeners, if you want to see this, just hop onto YouTube and find it, because I think it's important for you to see it as well. But talk to us about training with Kathy Freeman and that final.
Wow. Again, it's one of those moments that I'll never, ever forget. And I'm still grateful for the opportunity to train with Kathy that summer. My coach was, because he passed away at Ayofalona in 2015, he was a phenomenal coach, a great friend, great individual, quite eccentric at the same time. And he thought outside the box. And wouldn't tell. I always say that I was probably his guinea pig. I was the first athlete he coached, and it was very much trial and error. But he'd do things in an unorthodox way that some coaches would frown upon and be like, why is he doing that? But it worked. But he created this opportunity for me to train with Freeman without me even knowing it. I was at a competition, crossed the line, and her agent that she was working with approached me and said, ah, so you're training with Freeman. And I was like, pardon? Okay, I know who sorted that out now. So, yeah, I remember it like it was yesterday, rocking up at a local track near Uxbridge, Perivale, actually, for my first training session with her. And I knew Kathy before, you know, on the circuit, and we were juniors together. So we did have a bit of a friendship, a knowing of each other. And, yeah, that training session blew me away. I remember we were doing 200s, and I just feel sick just thinking about it. She was smaller and smaller and smaller with every repetition. And I was like, all I kept thinking is, Donna, you can't give up. Again, that little voice, you can't give up. You can't embarrass your coach. You know, you've just got to finish the session no matter how knackered you are. And that last rep, I crossed the line. Oh, my goodness. And all I kept thinking, just keep walking, just keep walking. Just don't show you're tired. But I was wiped out. It dawned on me where I thought I was actually quite fit. I was not, both mentally and physically. And I always say, I say it to the youngsters now, to be the best, you need to be around the best. And that doesn't necessarily mean from a sporting perspective, it's anything. If you want to excel, you need to be around the best to learn, listen, learn from your mistakes, learn from them, pick up all those hints and tips. And boy, did I learn. And that was a steep learning curve for me, because probably I didn't even respect how quick she was, you know, in my mind as an athlete. You know, you race, you know, Sabrina, when you don't go into a race thinking you're going to come second, third, fourth. You go into a race, you're going to win. Yeah. And that's how I saw it. So I didn't give her the respect she absolutely deserved. I thought, yeah, this training session, I've done this before. I can keep with her. Yeah, right. It was a different ball game. But, a phenomenal summer. I learned so much from her. I learned so much about myself. I just realized how much I loved 400 meters. You know, that mental barrier of this is going to be pain, I accepted it. It was an acceptance of, I accept I'm going to feel pain, but the only way I'm going to get better at this is just to give 110% every single training session and not focus on Freeman, focus on me. Yeah. And that made such a fundamental difference that over a period of time, I didn't even realize how fit I was getting. And that gap was getting shorter and shorter. I was closing that gap. And towards the end, I was on her shoulder in training. And again, I didn't think about it then. I was just thinking about me. Yeah. So when we got to Sydney, it was like, okay, this is Sydney, my second games. And I knew the ropes. I'd done that 4 years prior. I was in a couple of races with her, and you know, she was, you know, in the call room, I mean, so we'd see each other, we'd just give each other the glance, because she's not an outgoing person, so I knew how she was, and gave her that space, and arrived in the final, and the rest is history.
Donna, like, you just, you're gold today. You're just giving us gold. Like, for anyone listening to this, that whole, it's not about you against someone else. It's how much more can I be the best version of myself, whatever that is in, whether it's in life, whether it's in being a mum, a friend, an athlete, you know, that, you know, everything, you surround yourself with the best, surround yourself with those people because you can draw from them. It's so important thing, such an important thing to remember.
Absolutely. And, you know, we do it sometimes without even realizing. I try not to be negative. I really do. And people who are negative around me, I don't associate myself with them. I don't need it. It's draining. It's energy that I need to put elsewhere. So I have carried that forward as well. I surround myself with good people who want to do well for themselves, who are kind-hearted, who are not just healthy, but are just genuinely nice people, because it helps, especially during these challenging times. You need that.
Yeah, yeah. Oh. I mean, God, we could talk for ages, but I just, now, you talk about being positive and you know, going forward, I want to talk about 2009 when, you know, you were diagnosed with having breast cancer.
Yeah.
And I know you're an advocate for really amplification around the need for people to check themselves. But I think if I'm right, there isn't a history of breast cancer in your family.
Nope, nothing at all.
And I don't want to dramatize it, but gosh, how did you even begin to kind of deal with that, being a competitive athlete and then having that thrust upon you? Because I know later in that year you did retire from competitive athletics, but how did you come about, you know, knowing that there was a lump, et cetera, and getting the help that you needed?
Yeah, that year, I call it now 2009, because I had to own it. I had to own that year. It was a weird one because after 2008, my last Olympic Games, I thrusted myself into 2009 thinking, right, I need something different. So I did 400 meters indoors, which I'd never done before, with these long legs. Two laps of that is just a kill in itself. But I thought I needed another boost, something to look forward to, something to work towards. And I was really excited because I did okay. You know, we came away with a bronze medal in the relay at the European indoors. And I was happy. I was like, great. Looking forward to the outdoors, which would have been the world champs. And you know, Sabrina, as an athlete, you're in tune with your body. You know when things aren't right. You know when your body's not 100%. Something's not quite right. You might not be able to put your finger on it, but you know, either you're exhausted, whatever, you know something's not right. And as always, you know, I'd always check myself regardless, and I came across the lump. And I thought, oh, maybe I'm a bit run down because previous years I'd had glandular fever. And I thought it was that. I was just exhausted, training hard, lifted heavy weights. So I put it down to that. But at the same time, in the back of my mind, I was fully aware of all the news items and what you hear. You know, keep an eye on it if things change. You know, just keep an eye on it. And if not, then go and get it checked out. So I did just that. I followed all what I'd heard and knew about, you know, through the news and so forth. And I went to my GP and she immediately said, it's probably a cyst, but we should check it out. But regardless, you know, I'll refer you. And I went to get that checked out. And the surgeon then said, well, regardless, it needs to come out. We'd need to take it out and get it tested and so have a biopsy on it. So I did explain that I was an athlete and, you know, what's the process and I need to get back training and so forth. And they were brilliant. You know, we're hearing it about the NHS now, but I can't, even before this whole pandemic, they were amazing anyway. And she took that on board. So I had a lumpectomy in that May. I was back training after
my
that.
My God.
Yeah. Literally, you know, bandages and all, back competing, went away. And that was just a nightmare because it was so painful. But then when I went back for those results, it's bizarre. It's just a crazy feeling, that gutting feeling when you're thinking just, I have a feeling I'm going to get bad news today. And this is no word of a lie. Looking around in that waiting room, waiting for my name to be called, I was seeing posters of breast cancer. And I was like, oh, gosh, Donna, stop being silly. You're being silly. Yeah. You know, you're just making yourself worked up. And my name, you know, was called. I walked through the door. And I was followed in by another woman. And I was like, oh, this is strange. But I just thought, oh, maybe she's learning from Dr. Pogson, who was the woman who did the lumpectomy. And I sat down, and no word of a lie, Sabrina, Dr. Pogson started to talk, and her voice just trailed off. It was really an out-of-body experience where I could see what she was saying, but I couldn't hear a thing. And she mouthed the words breast cancer. And I was like, what is going on, you know? And she then started to talk again. And she said, this is Julie, your care nurse from Macmillan. She's going to go through the next steps with you in the next room. And I was like, ah, okay, so that's who you are. Now it makes sense. So we went into the side room, and I just burst into tears. I was like, ah. And then, of course, good old Diane showed up and gave me a few slaps and said, sort it out. Just listen to what the woman has to say, and let's just move on from this. And I did literally wipe my tears. I said, okay, tell me what I need to do. What do I need to do next? And I think she was a bit taken aback, and as that process went on, she was taken aback, because she said to my sister, because my sister went with me for a few of my appointments that followed, and she said, is Donna okay? Because she's taking this on quite well. And my sister said, that's how Donna is, you know, she'll see for what it is. You know, it's not that it's laughable. It's not about that. She'll be like, let's cut to the chase, do what I need to do. It threw me absolutely complete, because I didn't know where it was coming from. I was fit, I was well, ate well, all of that stuff. But it just goes to show, cancer does not discriminate. It really doesn't. And just being body aware, because I caught it early, so it was treatable. But of course, I was presented with the choice when I went to Royal Marsden to sit down and go through what my radiotherapy plan would be. And the professor there presented me with a question, again, I didn't expect would come. And it was like, well, have you considered a mastectomy? You know, a woman of your age, there's potential it would come back and all of that. And I was like, where the hell did that come from? So I went away, had conversations with my coach, my family, my friends, my physio, who was close to me. And you know what, Sabrina, each and every one of them said, we know you, Donna, do what's best for you. We can't make that decision for you. And it was Diane and me that had a good old chat. And I said, you know, we sat down, and it was, you know, do you want to, what would your life be if you just went through the radiotherapy? And I just, the thought process of going back time after time, wondering whether it had spread or not, I couldn't deal with that. So, and then I also started to look at my athletics career around the injuries, and, you know, going through that whole trauma of having treatment and then eventually having to have an operation. I thought, you know what, I'm done with that. I'm just cutting to the chase. And I had a mastectomy in December of 2009. So, it was tough. It was a tough decision, but I don't regret it whatsoever.
Oh, Donna, God, I'm close to tears here. I see the positivity and I see that, but as a woman, you know, as you know, a fellow sister and someone, as you say, that knows their body so well, to hear about, you know, you kind of going through that and you know, having to have that conversation with Diane. And I see so much of myself, and I'm sure that other women, you know, and men, because breast cancer, you know, although the percentage rate in women is higher, you know, men can get breast cancer too. I'm correct in that, aren't I?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You're spot on. We think that it's a female disease. It certainly isn't. Men are impacted as well.
Yeah. But, we have to do us, don't we? And at the end of the day, many people will have opinions or whatever, but ultimately it comes down to that conversation with self in terms of what is the right decision to make for our future long-term health and mental health too.
Absolutely. And that's the other thing, you know, us as women, we see our bodies, our body parts are us, you know, and that was the big question. Could I live with that? And I thought, come on, Donna, that's such a silly question, really. Some women do struggle with it. But I thought, who's going to see my body? Will people even know? You know, it's not that I walk around naked to Tesco's or Sainsbury's. You know, it's not about that. But that's a journey that every woman who's gone through this is different. Everyone will have a different view. But my journey was, you know what, I need to do this. And it's only if I tell my story that people will know. And my parents were dead against me telling my story. But I said the reason why I did it, it wasn't to put myself out there. It was simply because I wanted women to be body aware and get themselves checked out. If they know or feel something's not right, go and get it checked out. And also just check regularly so you are body aware. And if I could inspire or save a life, in fact, why would I not want to tell my story? So it was a battle with the family because, as you know, from a West Indian family, they like to keep everything quiet and contained. But I chose to. And the amount of Black women, in fact, that I've engaged with since telling my story has been amazing. You know, Donna, if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't have gone and checked it out. And I was caught it early or it was a cyst, whatever. But I'm so glad I went. So to me, that's done it for me.
And isn't that just the power in, it leads us quite nicely into my kind of next question, but isn't that the power, Donna, in us as women with platforms, us as women with voices and with stories to tell, that even if it means us being vulnerable or uncomfortable, having those kind of conversations, that just saving one life or just giving one person the confidence to visit the doctor or to, you know, even breaking it down to trail running for me in feeling safe enough and confident enough to go out and walk or run a mile, that if we can just empower even one more person, job done.
Absolutely. And that's what gets me up in the morning, you know, not necessarily from a breast cancer perspective, but general day. If I can impact one person to be positive, whether it's what I say or do, then that's my job done. You know, I can go to sleep very well. And I think it's important. We have a purpose where we've all been put on this earth for a purpose, not to make other people miserable, by no means, to make a difference, a positive difference. And that's what I believe I was put on this earth to do.
Oh, well, I do too. And it kind of leads me on to you being appointed as UK Athletics first. Very first, I don't want to get ED&I lead. What did land in that role mean to you? And it's kind of a question that is kind of open, really. But how do you feel that the work that you've done has impacted the sport or impact athletics at elite and grassroots level? But also, ultimately, how do you feel that the work that you and colleagues, you know, we talk about team effort, we talk about, you know, surrounding yourself with the right people, but how do you feel, the second part of that question would be, that the work that you do will continue to impact, you know, the lives of those people who have been in the past discriminated against because of ability or because of color of skin, etc. So yeah, first part of the question, what did it mean to you to get that first role that they had created in ED&I?
Yeah, it was definitely a surprise, because once I retired from athletics for good, because I did come out of retirement to go for 2012 from an inspirational perspective, I thought, right, once I've hung my spikes up, that's it. I won't be involved so much as I was, but I would still support my club in any which way possible. So I'd been working at EDF Energy for 18 years, and I did hit a glass ceiling there, and I didn't see a career path for myself. And when this role came up, it was a dream come true, really, because it was in a sport that I absolutely love and want to give something mm-hmm. back to. And then likewise, a passion for ED&I. So, you know, what a combination. So to get this role meant more than just a job. And I don't ever do something just for the sake of it. It's not a job to me. This is me. You know, whatever yeah. I do, deliver, reflects me as a person. So I have to be passionate about what I'm doing. Otherwise, I won't bother. The role itself primarily was to embed our core values into the organisation through our practices, how we are as an organisation, and also to achieve the equality standard in sport advanced level, because currently we're at the intermediate level. And just to bring that to life a bit, because your listeners may not know what this is. In simple terms, it's literally holding up an ED&I mirror to us as an organisation and identifying the areas that we are not only doing good things in this space, but also the areas that we need to improve in. So that could be around representation. It mm-hmm. could be around disability. It could be anything, but relative to the sport itself. So many sports have gone through this process, but we're trying for the advanced level, which is a step up. And I'm not one for a tick box exercise by no means, but going through this process has really identified what we need to focus on, but also celebrate the good stuff we do. As a sport, we don't celebrate the good sport stuff that we do, which means the focus is always on the bad things, which yeah. is such a shame. So we need to be better at that. But at the same time, it's not dismissing the areas we need to improve on. So, It's the role itself is huge. It's grown. It's not just about those two areas. I have taken it to another level, because whatever it says on my JD, I never just stick to that. I push yeah. those boundaries. I widen that net a little bit more. I am a creative individual, so trying to find innovative ways to make sure that we're driving this agenda. Everyone's accountable. Everyone's responsible for this, although this is my job. It's bringing people with me to understand what ED&I means. It's not just a tick box exercise. It's about people, and that's what's important. And understanding and listening what the issues are, and then putting plans in place to address them and put them right, and not just be, okay, well, we've listened. We're not going to do anything else now.
Yeah.
So for me, I always say this, my aim is to make myself redundant so that, you know, everything and practices, how we behave, continues and is fully embedded. But it's not something that can happen overnight. It is about people and mindsets and how we are as individuals and who we want to be as a sport. And that's important. What is our vision? And right now, leadership are looking at our whole strategy, and part and parcel of that is the ED&I work. Not a standalone piece. It's got to be fully interweaved into that strategy.
And you know what I love about the how we came together, you know, I was contacted via my athletics club who had sent out an email, I think from UKA, saying last year that there was, you know, going to be a Let's Talk About Race panel. And I, you know, absolutely saw it drop into my inbox and was like, I have to be part of that. So kind of put myself forward and then was invited along to some workshops, etc. Which led to, you know, you kindly asking me if I would chair a comms panel, and then being asked to be on the, you know, the newly formed Race Equality Network as well. So my experience of you and Lorna, who, you know, has been working closely with you on that, is that you're women and a woman who, it's not just about writing it down in a proposal, filing it away and saying, you know, tick box, we've done that. It's about how, as you said, how can we embed this into culture so that actually I don't need to be here anymore, you know, because we're doing it. It's natural. It's happening. And isn't that ultimately what we're striving for across ED&I in everything that we do?
Absolutely. And, you know, funny enough, when I deliver some workshops around this space, you know, I'm not the ED&I police by no means. It's not about that. The sport did need someone to drive this, and so many other sports need that as well. And then it can just gently be fully embedded. But you're right. That whole piece of work that we got you involved in, this is exactly what I'm talking about. It wasn't just a one-stop shop where we did the workshops and it's forgotten about. You're on this journey now, Sabrina, with us. Mm. And I suspect you will be on the journey with us for a long time. And it's not my style. We have to keep moving forward. And other people will join. We'll pick people up on the way. People may drop out, but it's their choice to do that. It's not the case of me saying, right, we're at the end of the project, because it's not a project. This is life. This is our sport. This is who we want to be. We want to be better. We want to be more inclusive. And by no means, we're not the best, but we know where the areas we need to work on, and we are striving towards that. And it won't happen overnight, because we're changing the culture. Culture doesn't change overnight. It's just having the right people, as you said, Sabrina, to drive it. And I call everyone who I work with my foot soldiers, because I can't clone myself. So there's people out there. We're growing this network of people who understand and know what this is all about.
Yeah, but I mean, that I was, you know, I say again, I was just so privileged to be asked. And actually, in previous episodes of The Checkpoint, you know, we've interviewed Annika and Nora, we've interviewed Imani, and, you know, we've spoke to them candidly, you know, about, you know, I know with Annika, you know, last year around the rise in the BLM protests, she did a piece for the Huffington Post talking about her experiences being an elite athlete and experiencing racism, and that her absolute need to amplify and to do that piece, which, you know, led to a lot of positive comments, but also a lot of negative comments too. And I know that it's something that we've discussed in terms of, you know, being open about the, you know, the positive stories, absolutely, but also amplifying, you know, these experiences that are being experienced at elite and grassroots level, because it happens, you know, it happens at local and rural athletics clubs too, you know. So I think that I'm really proud of what the work that we're doing with the Race Equality Network and you know, and shining a light, you know, in terms of those situations or you know, what the word on the street that we hear in terms of what's going on and reporting back to you about that. Because, you know, it's a journey. It's, you know, it's an ongoing journey. And you know, one that I'm, you know, one that I am absolutely, you know, proud to be part of. And it feels as if with the work that we do with Black Trail Runners, it was always meant to be, you know, and I was always kind of supposed to kind of meet people like you, etc. But how do you feel? I mean, I read some pieces about some athletes maybe wanting to show their support of BLM, maybe with a bending of the knee or however they feel appropriate in order to bring that to the fore. But obviously with the Olympics, you're not, you know, there's no political demonstrating, etc., etc. So what are your thoughts on that? And should athletes be allowed to show their support of causes like BLM, or is that something where the time to do that is not at the Olympic Games? What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so last year at our British Championships athletics, we did put a statement out after the George Floyd murder, and it was obviously close to our British Championships, and we put a note out to our athletes if they wanted to show some kind of make a statement, whatever they wanted to do, we would fully support them. And you know, some did, some chose to in different ways, and we supported them, and they were grateful for that. We even put Black Lives Matters on our bibs for those British Championships for them, and again they were grateful that we were standing up for the Black athletes within the team. So if we fast forward now to the Olympic Games, we don't have control of that. Mm-hmm. It would sit under the British Olympic Association for Team GB. So I do not know what they will decide to do. It's I haven't been in contact with the person who's leading on ED&I at the BOA as yet, but it would be their choice. We wouldn't have control of that as UK Athletics, but I would urge them to support. I know Commonwealth Games next year is coming up, and they're looking at a lot of this because, of course, Commonwealth countries is extremely diverse.
Absolutely.
So they're looking at that. ED&I conversation as a whole, and especially being in the heart of Birmingham, which is extremely diverse. So they really are looking at that, which is brilliant to hear. Tokyo will be interesting. I really don't know what their plans are and whether they will support that if their athletes do. That's a conversation for the BOA, definitely. But I think, you know, the right thing to do would be to support athletes if that's what they want to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, we're seeing it, you know, across sport, you know, in the sense of, you know, Ife Inora taking on his new role. Is it the PFA? Excuse me if I've got that wrong, the kind of equality, diversity and role there. We're seeing, you know, what's gone on in football, you know, with kind of racism and clubs deciding that they won't let the players take the knee or that, et cetera. So I think it's a really divisive, almost in a way, discussion that's happening. But ultimately, I think, you know, athletes should be allowed to show or not show if they feel that how they feel about racism in sport and how they feel about, you know, issues around Black Lives Matter, as it were. And certainly, you know, again, with Black Trail Runners, one of our tenets is about representation. And that leads me on to just a couple of final questions I have for you. The first one being, focusing on the sentence, you can't be what you can't see. What do you see as being the main kind of barriers for people of colour, let's say, when it comes to athletics and running, and how can we continue to address those?
I think the number one barrier is opportunity. I will always say one of my, you know, it's out there. I can't even say it's my quote, but, you know, if opportunity doesn't knock, I always say, well, make your own door and knock it down as hard as you can. And I do believe in that, because sometimes the opportunities may not be there, but you have to navigate and find a way to create those opportunities in some cases. You know, I put myself out there around the ED&I space, and so many opportunities have been brought towards me. But at the same time, I had to create them and reach out and say, well, what's happening in this space? You know, how can I support and so forth? But yeah, I think opportunity is one of the number one barriers, and that is coming through so much. It came out of the Let's Talk About Race conversations. It's coming out of the recent research that was done by the Female Coaching Network. So, you know, if we think about intersectionality, for example, there are a lot of barriers for women, full stop, but let alone barriers for Black women as well on top of that, you know. So to see it, to be it, I'm one of those people, and I do really try to create opportunities for people who look like me and others. You know, I do see it from a women perspective, but at the same time, we're looking at our sport, athletics, it is extremely diverse, all colours, sizes, disabilities, completely diverse. We need to create opportunities for people who are within our sport as well. And that's not from a participation perspective only. That's also from the administration side of things as well. So, yeah, I do see myself as a role model, and I need to create those opportunities for people who look like me and for others who may not have that opportunity, especially disabilities. You know, we've got an arm of para athletes who are phenomenal athletes, but yet we don't have many people with a disability working in an administration. So, you know, it's not just an ethnicity thing. It's across some of the other protected characteristics as well.
It's the representation piece of work, you know, whether it's Black, brown, you know, disability, it's women, it's, you know, and you know, we have a job to do in order to create an environment that is representing all. And when you're in an environment and making decisions in an environment that doesn't have, you know, we talk about being around the table, you know, how can you possibly create strategy, create initiative, create change when you're not represented around the table? And that is, I know for you, that's absolutely, you know, something that you talk about a lot. And the same for us at Black Trail Runners. How, you know, how a trail running event organization round table, can you talk about how to increase the diversity in trail running when you do not have Black and Brown people in that conversation? It's impossible. My final question to you is, you know, we set up Black Trail Runners last July. Sometimes it feels like it was just yesterday. Other times, if you're having a particularly difficult day trying to engage with people who don't want to see the outdoors as being non-inclusive, it can seem like forever. But what piece of advice, Donna, would you give us as a fairly new community and campaigning group, all about creating access, skills and representation of Black people in trail running? What piece of advice would you give us for our journey?
Ah, that's a really good question. Piece of advice, perseverance. I think, you know, I know you have, Sabrina, you know, leading the way in terms of having a plan. You have your vision, you know where you want to be, you know where you want to take the Black Trail Runners, but it's not going to be an easy road. I know you will aim high, absolutely. I'm not knocking that at all, yeah. Because I'm always one to say aim high and just reach for the sky. It's perseverance. It's sticking to what you believe in, absolutely, and don't let anyone else sway you. You will get critics along the way. You will get knocked. And that's the same mindset you have as an athlete, and you know that, Sabrina, that there's always going to be something. But again, go back to what I said at the very beginning. It's whether you choose to stay down or get up and keep fighting. And if you truly believe in what you're saying and doing, nothing should stop you or stand in your way. So perseverance is absolutely number one.
Oh, Donna, I could talk to you all day. Honestly, like, so much great stuff in this interview. Where can people follow your journey or follow the initiatives that you create or the charities that you support? Where's the best place for people to follow Donna or Diane when she decides to come out?
I'm going to have to draw a picture of Diane. Well, actually, she looks She does look just like me. She just has a little bit more bigger. So where can you find me? On Instagram at Donna Legs with a Z. And the same with Twitter as well, same at Donna Legs with a Z. And I am in the process of building my website, so that will be out soon, fingers crossed. So I'll definitely announce that on Twitter, Twitter, Instagram, and of course on Facebook as well. I do have a page there. And I'm on LinkedIn. I put all my business stuff on LinkedIn without fail, because I think, you know, there's separate groups of people that follow me. So from a business perspective, LinkedIn. From a fun perspective, all the other social media channels.
Oh, Donna, thank you so much for your time today, this Monday morning, this International Women's Day. You are a woman who inspires and continues to, yeah, keep me persevering and keep me shooting for the stars. And I'm very grateful for the work that we're doing. And follow Donna, support that which she's doing, and continue to be inspired. Thanks for listening to this interview, everyone. Subscribe if you don't already. And let's keep up to date with what's going on in the world of Donna / Diane Fraser.
Thank you, my lovely.
So it is time for this week's A to Z of trail running. What letter are we on, Donna?
I think it's J this week, Sabrina, and we've had some very interesting suggestions from our lovely Facebook community on Black Trail Runners.
Hit us up. What suggestions did we get for Jay?
We've got joy, journey, jackets, jogging, jam sandwiches, and Jaffa cakes.
What I love about trail runners is the ability to almost in every one of the letters for the A to Z so far get a food stuff in there.
Indeed.
So let's leave food stuff to the end, because then that'll probably make me hungry and I'll probably go to the shop and get some. But let's talk about kit first. Jackets. What jackets do you have in your running wardrobe, Donna?
From a perspective of just trail running jackets or just running jackets in general?
All sorts of jackets. Let's start with trail running jackets first.
Yeah, okay. So I've only got one I would say was a decent one. Or not just one decent one, because they're all decent jackets, everyone. Just one that my go-to one, because it ticks the box for the mandatory kit list with the sealed seams and it's waterproof and blah, blah, blah. And it's really light and you can pack it away and stuff. So, but other jackets, I've just got so many jackets. I should open a shop.
Do you have a favourite one? Do you have a favourite jacket? Would be your like, okay, if I'm going to pack and I'm going to go to any race, then I want to have this jacket in my suitcase.
Right, okay. So the current one I'm wearing is, are we allowed to say brands or?
Yes, yeah, you okay, can.
Right, so
you
it's Montane. And yeah. I just absolutely love it because it's waterproof, it's light, it ticks all the boxes, it fits me really well. It's like I say, it's light, and it's light enough to whip off and tie around my waist if I get too hot, which I invariably do. Ladies, it's an age thing. You'll get there one day. So that's kind of like my go-to that at the moment that I would pack and take anywhere. But I mean, I'm quite new. I'm not new to trail running as such, but I am quite new to sort of attire for trail running because I all just go out, and as long as the shoes are decent, then everything else I'm not really that fussed about. If I get wet, I get wet. But then I've never sort of run in really extreme conditions where I've had to sort of really think about my kit and what I need to wear. So Montane is the one. It's my go-to at the moment. What about you?
Oh my God, you know what? I can remember when I first got into running and I would see people out in these like fancy jackets and I'd be like, you don't need a fancy jacket. All you need is a pair of trainers. And I think to a point that is true. Trainers are like number one, like footwear is like number one. You get your footwear right, everything else falls into place. But what I've realized, you know, you talked about mandatory kit, and I think it's probably quite good that we talk about that, because when you get into doing more trail races for any kind of new people that are new to trail running out there, what you'll often get as part of like the race registration is like a mandatory kit list. And what they will say on there, on some races, not all, is that your jacket has to have taped seams. Yeah. Now, I don't know if you can explain it, but is that just so that it doesn't let water in?
Yeah, that is it. Like that's nail on the head. Yeah,
because I can remember when I first, I was like, well, why does a jacket need taped seams? But it makes sense, because if you're out on the trail and if you're at a UK trail race, the likelihood of you coming across a rain shower or heavy downpour is more than 50% a possibility. You know, if you are doing trail races, then I think it's a good idea to start looking at jackets and looking for them to have that in their specification. Yeah. You know, I'm very grateful because at the moment I'm sponsored by a kit manufacturer, and therefore I get loads of jackets to test and stuff like that. I love, my favorite jacket at the moment is my waterproof, and it's proper, proper waterproof. Like, it doesn't let any wetness in. It also doesn't let any wetness out really that much. But there's nothing worse for me as a trail runner than being out on a run, either at the beginning or the middle, and not having a jacket that is going to keep heavy rain off me.
Yeah.
So I wear an Innovate Storm Storm Shell jacket, and it's just a really great light, as you said, like you talked about having a light jacket, because the last thing you want when you're out on the trails is to be carrying a heavy jacket, either whether it's tied around your waist or whether it's in your bag. You want it to be lightweight. You want it to be, I want it to be waterproof. Yeah. And just like pack it up and go if I need to, or if I'm wearing it, it doesn't feel cumbersome. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So I think that at the moment is my favorite jacket. But same as you, Donna, I'm of an age where I have been, you know, the women out there, you know what we're saying, you know, the sweats, you know, I'm getting very hot a lot of the time. So I'm just finding that, you know, even today, yesterday, when I was out on my run, I was whipping off my jacket within a mile. I was like, this is far too warm. It's far too much.
Mine are 5 degrees and we're like running in vests.
Yeah, exactly. We are the runners, people, that you see around. You're like, why are those women in vests? And it's like, because we're so hot and there's nothing much we can do about it. Let's go on to the next one. There was one suggestion that kind of really made me think, I'd like us to talk about that. And that's journey. Mm. That's the journey. You know, I think many people who started running will have started as road runners, maybe.
Yeah.
And I started as a road runner and loved road running for years. I just loved pounding the pavements. And the journey into trail running for me was very much at a time in my life where I was a little bit lost and needed a bit of a challenge, and decided that I wanted to do a massive Sahara desert based ultramarathon for my 40th birthday. And that the decision to do that introduced me to trail running, and trail running has been a real lifesaver. You know, trail running has been my journey from when I first set foot on terrain that wasn't tarmac has been one of the most life-changing, the most joyful journeys from a sport and an exercise perspective that I could have ever, ever imagined. And you know, the journey to my journey in trail running led me to you. It led me to Black Trail Runners. Yep. It led to so many amazing things that have happened in my life, new friends, more awareness about who I am as a woman and a mother and an athlete and a person. And I, you know, if I could worship at the god of trail running, that probably, if I could put on the census, because we've just had the census here in the UK, haven't we, Donna? If there was a religion and you could, I would, maybe there was and I missed it, I would say trail running is, it's spiritual for me. How is it, what's your journey? What was your journey into trail running, Donna?
I'm a bit like you as well, that I keep saying that I'm not a massive trail runner. I mean, I've run sort of on trails on and off all my life, but I am a dedicated road runner as well. I switch between the two quite a lot. But I remember when I was running marathons, and I like to run them quickly, not stopping, I'm not a fast runner, but I don't like this stopping and starting thing, and I couldn't get my head around like doing a marathon where you had to stop, because it wasn't a little speed bump, it was a mountain that you were going up. And and I learned the hard way. I turned up for South Downs Way marathon back in 2014 with the idea in my head that, I'm just going to ace this in sub 4.5 hours and like just let me go. And like within 2 miles, I was like dying, because I had no idea. You know, for me, trails, you go out and you run them, you walk them, but you don't race them. And that's what I didn't realize, that, like, of course you do race them if you've trained to race them, but you don't race them like a road race. And my memories of, like, running on 12s was back at school and training in cross country on Wimbledon Common and crying or hiding until the time was up and get back on the bus to go back to school. I hated it. I hated cross country, which was really weird because where I grew up, we had lots of commons right next to where I grew up, like Putney and Barnes Common, and we were always over there as kids, and I really loved it. I just didn't realise how much I loved it and how great it was for me to be out on the trails mainly for my mental health. But I'm still, like, traumatised by that incident in 2014, South Downs Way Marathon, and it's taken me a long, long time to fall back in love with trail running. I love the freedom of the freedom that trail running gives me. I can just disengage and just not think about anything. Like today, I went out for a little recovery run, and like within 5 minutes of cars and everything, I just took a little side path and was on a trail for like 4 months. Four miles, and I just absolutely loved it. I just love just the fact that I can disengage, and for me, it's still a journey. You know, I'm still sort of on that journey. I don't think, if I'm going to be totally honest, I don't think I've made that complete transition to being solely a trail runner. I just see myself at the moment as a runner. I love running trails, but I love road running equally as well. So, but for me, yeah, it is still that journey, which hopefully will never end, because I absolutely love it. I love being out there. I love, like, this whole, like I say, this whole feeling of total freedom and, you know, like just being totally disengaged with everything and everyone. I just absolutely love it.
There's nothing like it.
Yeah.
I mean, and I searched for so many years in my own personal journey for that feeling of being able to disengage, or even, you know, in the journey of trail running, in the day-to-day journey of starting a run and just having so much going through your mind, and then, you know, the cadence of the legs and the different pacing of the cadence of the legs, whether you're on an incline or a decline or you know, terrain that's quite, you know, that kind of metronome of movement through the trails and how that changes. I think it's a really meditative experience.
And
something that I'm so passionate about in other people experiencing that I just don't see the journey ever ending.
No, you know,
I just want to do it, and any trail runner or runner, you know, that I talk to, you know, if they found a sport or a hobby or a passion that give them that joy, that freedom, that disengagement, why would you want to?
But I have to confess, I don't know what it is. I just think you're all weirdos because I don't get this thing with mud. You know, I don't understand it. Somebody needs to explain to me, like, what is this obsession with trail runners and mud? You know, give me a lovely trail that's dry underfoot, you know, and there's no up to your eyeballs in mud and being caked in mud and post it on social media. Like, I love mud. It's like, no, I don't. I do not love mud.
Donna, by the time I finish with you, you will be putting it all over you. I love mud. I love mud. I love, if I see a mud pit, I just kind of can't help myself but run straight through the middle
of it.
You're
like that little child, aren't you, that you see, they see this massive puddle and they have to run through it, and they don't run through it, they just stop and splash for a bit. That is you with mud. That is not me in mud. No. Mud bath. Yes. No.
Sabrina's mission for Donna to impassion Donna with a love of mud and mud baths and playing in mud by the end of this journey.
No, not going to happen. It's so not going to happen.
Well, this is
going to be 5 years' time, and I'd be like the world's best advocate for mud.
Yeah, you will. You'd be like, oh, there was a time. There was a time I hated mud, and I can remember saying it on a podcast. I hate mud. I hate mud now.
I blame my secondary school. They traumatized me when I was, cross country. They made it like something that you had to hate. And that, I think that's what it is,
that trauma of childhood cross country experience.
Freezing cold. Yeah. It's like, why do people, why are they smiling? Like, stop smiling. It's horrible.
You've never got the wrong conditions, Donna. You've only got the wrong kit.
Indeed.
Let's go on now then to talk about jam sandwiches and Jaffa cakes.
Right. Okay.
I tell you what, I didn't have a jam sandwich, I think, from probably the age of, the age of 9 until probably the age of 39. And the first experience as a late 30s woman that I had, which was spiritual again, was a jam sandwich at a checkpoint aid station on an ultra marathon. And it was like liquid gold in my mouth.
Hang on a minute. You didn't have a jam sandwich between the age of 9 and 39. Goodness me, if I go for a week without a jam sandwich, I'm dying.
I don't know. I associated jam sandwiches with we grew up, we didn't have much money, jam sandwich like in our packed lunches.
Oh my God. No,
so it was like, why would I want a jam sandwich? And then when I got that jam sandwich, not only was it just exactly what I needed, the white bread, the butter, the jam. Oh. But it also just restoked all those childhood memories, actually, of like summers with jam sandwiches going out for picnics on the commons and in the fields and stuff like that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I totally get that. I couldn't go for that many years without a jam sandwich. Jam and peanut butter, jam and banana jam and ham, jam with everything. Jam on everything. Jam on chips. Jam.
Jam on chips. I mean, this is the thing for our American listeners. I know that because I've seen it in films and I've seen it on TV programs, like peanut butter and jelly.
Oh my God.
So I mean, no, jelly is jam, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Jello, yeah.
I've got a thing. I can't eat peanut butter because I just, not that I've, and I've never tried because I just don't like the idea of peanuts being smashed into a butter like. It's so weird. So the thought of putting peanut butter and jam in a sandwich, I don't know that I could ever try it.
Oh my God, it's just so lovely.
Really?
Yeah, I'm like salivating now. Like, thank God we're not on camera.
And this was the reason I wanted to hold off the conversation about
goodness. Food. Oh, and raspberry jam's my favourite. Like, such strawberry jam, it's raspberry jam.
It's raspberry jam,
raspberry
is it?
Jam, yeah. But jam and peanut butter,
But this is the reason that people on our Facebook page have suggested when we said jam, they were like, well, when we said J, they were jam sandwiches. Because again, in terms of fuel while you're out on the trail.
Yeah, and they're just easy to do as well. Like you can cut them up in little tiny posh squares and they're like a good substitute as well for gels as well, because you've got the right amount of like sugar and carbs and what have you.
Now you're making me want to go into the kitchen and make a jam sandwich.
Peanut butter, maybe a banana.
Not peanut butter. A banana. Yeah. Banana and jam though.
Oh, Sabrina. Sabrina.
You know what? We spoke at length about culture, about food, how food's so important to us. Mm. I think if we ever have a Black Trail Runners, and I say if we ever, when we have a Black Trail Runners event at our checkpoint, at our aid stations, I think we're definitely going to have jam sandwiches.
Yeah, we have to like have...
We're definitely going to have Jaffa cakes.
Definitely, yep. Jaffa cakes.
We're definitely going to, all the good stuff.
Indeedy. Yeah, indeed. And like going on like to Jaffa Cakes, I mean, with me, it's like, what is the obsession with people and Jaffa Cakes? I mean, I used to love Jaffa Cakes. At the moment, I'm going through a little phase of a wannabe vegan. And so I'm sort of 8 months into that journey and craving fried chicken like nobody's business. Jaffa Cakes, I kind of like get why people love them at aid stations, because they're just right. They've just got that the right kick to them, like just to take the edge off everything, you know. For our American listeners, I don't know if you get Jaffa Cakes overseas. They're not actually, well, actually technically they are cakes.
Well, this is the thing, is a Jaffa Cake, I mean, we're getting into tough ground here, Donna. Is a Jaffa Cake a biscuit or a cake? You're saying it's a cake.
Well, I would say it the consistency, it's a cake.
It's cake-like.
It's cake-like. It was deemed a cake. A little bit of like boring trivia here. It was deemed a cake for VIP purposes. I think McVitie's took prize there, like their co-founders or whatever, to court just to decide, and they just deemed for tax purposes that it is actually a cake and not a biscuit. And for our American listeners as well, not necessarily our American listeners, anyone out there that doesn't have the joy of Jaffa Cakes, we've enjoyed Jaffa Cakes in the UK since 1927. And they've, I think we've been having that debate about whether they're a Jaffa Cake or a biscuit that time, as well as like, how do you eat them?
Well, this is the thing. So anyone that doesn't know what a Jaffa Cake is, so let me try and explain. And we really shouldn't spend most of the age of that talking about Jaffa Cakes, but it's kind of like a cake. It's a little round cake stroke biscuit with a kind of a denser sponge base with a dollop of what I would consider like a marmalade jam, yeah, maybe in the middle, covered by a thin top little hat of chocolate. Yeah. And together those three ingredients make the Jaffa Cake.
And they're made from Jaffa oranges, hence the name Jaffa Cake.
Hence the name Jaffa Cakes. Now, how do you eat yours then, Donna?
Depends on how hungry I am or when I used to eat them. Shove them in one at a time, or I can do a packet in 2 minutes, or I just like sometimes nibble around the edge. So like all the way round, and so you're left with just the middle bit where the majority of like the jam and the whatever it is, and then you just pop that into your mouth as well.
So there's
that way as well. But more often than not, I'm just like can't get enough of them.
Yeah, I mean the thing is, they are. If you haven't tried a Jaffa Cake, then you know you need to get involved in
this.
I mean, most of the time, if I'm in one of those moods, I can demolish a small pack, you know, 10, 11 Jaffa Cakes, yeah, like a minute probably, you know, just constantly as if they're crisps, they're going in. If I'm trying to be a little bit more, I want to say ladylike, there's nothing ladylike about it, but if I'm trying to be more to savor, I will take the top bit of chocolate off, nibble around the jam, and then in goes the sponge. You know, it's very much a what, you know, how my hormone levels are doing on that particular day. I'm the person that you see looking at the meter long tub of Jaffa Cakes at Christmas. Yeah. You know, I'm the person that you see in the supermarket just standing, looking and thinking, this probably isn't a good idea for me to be buying this.
No.
And then I'm the person you see running out with the meter long pack of Jaffa Cakes and zooming away in the car.
And there isn't actually a vegan version, unless anyone knows otherwise. I've seen lots of vegan recipes for Jaffa Cakes, but it's not the same. You know, it's not the same. It's like when you were really young and you wanted a Big Mac and you had to have rather than a McDonald's, you had a McMummy, and it didn't taste the same. Yeah, like Mummy's burger, it wasn't McDonald's, and yeah,
yeah,
so,
yeah, yeah. So, you know, we can't promise you at aid stations of all races there will be Jaffa cakes. And obviously in these COVID times, what we can get at aid stations has become limited anyway until we get back to whatever our new normal is. But Jaffa cakes and jam sandwiches are certainly should be part of the go-to fuel for any trail runner. So get involved in it, people. That is the A to Z for this week. We hope you've just enjoyed listening to us talking about our experience. And remember, it's our experience here. We are not experts. We never claim to be, but we hope that by sharing some of the kit we like, the foods we like, the trails we like, our experiences, it inspires you to maybe go and try something new or not and really, really enjoy your journey out on the trails. So Donna, thank you for doing that with me this week.
Thank you, Sabrina.
And we'll see you out on the trails soon.
Indeedy. Take care, everyone.
Thank you for joining us at The Checkpoint.
If you've enjoyed this conversation, please subscribe and share online.
Also, please remember to leave your review on the podcast platform that you selected, as it really helps our podcast to grow.
Your support helps make this podcast possible.
Remember, if you have any questions, get in touch with us via our Instagram page at Black Trail Runners, or if you want to join our community, please search Facebook for Black Trail Runners and connect with us.